Well, I'm excited about the start of our gospel meeting. I hope you are too. As you know, we're going to be looking on Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday at science and the Bible. And I've done a lot of that information already in sermons for you. I've tried to rearrange that and bring some more stuff into it that the members here will still find interesting and hopefully engaging and encouraging, but also hopeful that we can get some others who have not heard that can hear those messages. And the thing we want people to take away from these kinds of lessons is the strength to oppose the opposition that is just hurled at us everywhere in our society that are anti-God. And so I'm going to look at a couple lessons today that go along with the theme of the meeting. They're not so much exactly like the science in the Bible, but today we're going to look at evidences of a young earth this morning. And tonight we're going to look at a lesson about dinosaurs. And these are things that are usually very interesting to people. And I hope that you find these interesting. But more than that, I hope that as we consider these things, that they will allow you to have an understanding of just how great our God is. And by the time we get done with these lessons today and the week, the most amazing thing we'll find about the fact that God created the heavens, the earth, and all that's in them in 6 days is why he took so long. Not that he only took six days to do it, but we have a God that's so awesome that really the amazing thing is that he chose to take a whole week. And he did that to give us an example of our work week and our setting aside time to worship and serve God. And so we'll see all kinds of things that the Bible teaches us. Not that it's a science book, not that it's trying to teach us science, but that it considers those things when it talks about other things. And the result is we can confirm the accuracy of the Bible, and we can confirm the fact that it is all inspired, that it is God-breathed and given to us to demonstrate to us just how awesome our God really is. So that's what we hope to take from the lessons as we go through the week. This morning, we want to consider the topic that has just been under brutal assault for a number of years. Brother Ron informed me just yesterday that in the 40s, when he took a zoologist class in college, that he was just bombarded with the evolutionist stuff so much that it caused him to change his course of study.
Grade school.
Grade school, okay. Sorry about that. But that these things back in the 40s were taught, and I didn't understand that. I thought that as I came through school in Kentucky, we didn't get hit with it until high school, and then it was a theory of evolution that we were taught. And now it permeates all subjects. If you pick up a textbook from school, high school particularly, but even kindergarten stuff, will somewhere start talking about millions of years. We see it in TV shows. We see it in movies that are designed for children. We see this in just so many different aspects that it's easy for us to become conditioned to think, well, maybe somehow that's right and it works. We're going to look at God's word and the fact that it doesn't work. But beyond that, we're going to look at evidences that exist in the world today, scientific evidences that demonstrate that the earth is young. Many of these ignored by scientists, many of them acknowledged by science, but then just thrown aside because they don't want to or can't deal with them. I was taught growing up that the world was created in 6 days. But I was taught you believe it because God said it and that settles it. That's good for us and our faith. But the problem is when we're constantly bombarded with people who are supposed to be educated, people who are supposed to be the smart ones, telling us different, that chips away at the fact when all we have is God said it and that settles it. Maybe it shouldn't be that way, but oftentimes it is. And the fact is, there's so much evidence that shows us that the earth is young. In Exodus chapter 31 and verse 17, it says, "It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed." And so he tells us here, this was talking about the Sabbath day and how he sanctified it because he rested on the seventh day. But it tells us clearly, plainly, and concisely that the Lord made heaven and earth in 6 days. The Genesis account in chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. And we could go through and read a lot more verses about this, but we're going to look at these verses. It says, "Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. And on the seventh day, God ended his work, which he had made, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work, which he had made. And God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he had rested from all his work, which God created and made." So the Bible tells us that he created the heavens and the earth and all that in them is in 6 days. You can go through Genesis 1. It gives an account of what happened each day. And at the end of telling what happened on each day, he says, "And there was evening, and there was morning, and it was the whichever day it was." So he clearly defines what a day was. It was a morning and an evening. And he clearly states that he created everything that is in the heavens and the earth in 6 days. And then he rested. Now, there are many arguments for an old earth. And as we look at those things and we see them on the surface, it's very easy to tend to agree with those things, that some things look old. And there are many different thoughts that have been put forth to try to merge the Bible into old earth thinking. And I want to look just at a couple of them as we get started. And one of them is a gap theory. And in that is that between Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1 and between verse 1 and 2, there is a gap. And when verse 2 says, "The earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters," that word "was" can mean became. And so what it says is that the earth became without form and void. And there was a whole creation that went before that. And that creation was destroyed, the earth became void, and God recreated the earth. And that's what begins in verse 2. There are several problems with that theory. Number one, God beginning on day one and saying he saw the light and said that it was good. And each time that he creates something, he says it was good. And when he finishes, he looks at his creation and says it was very good. It's hard for me to imagine that he created that upon a world that was destroyed, death, decay, and destruction, and then build a new world on top of it and said it's very good. And it's hard to imagine that there would be no other reference to that world in the Bible. If there was a world that was like that and was destroyed in that way, don't you think there's a lot of lessons we can learn from that world? Just like our world that was destroyed in the time of Noah's flood. there would be a whole other set of lessons that we could learn. So I believe we would be told about that. And then there's the theory that the days were very long days, millions or perhaps even billions of years. Because the word that is used in the Bible for day is the word, the Hebrew word yom. And it came from a word which can mean a period of time. In fact, the base meaning of that word is a period of time. And I don't have any problem saying that that's right. The word day meant a period of time. That's why he was so careful in defining what that period of time was. It was a morning and an evening. A yom, a period of time that encompassed one morning and one evening. Of course, people say, well, the sun and the earth and all that wasn't yet set in motion. And that's true. But God made light. He separated the light from the darkness. The light he called day and the darkness he called night. A morning and an evening made one day. So even at best, you could get through the first couple of days, because when you started creating plants, if that day was millions of years long, then the plants would have to live millions of years without sunlight. And we know that's impossible. So he separated right off the bat day from night, and he called that a day. There is a way to distinguish a long period of time. He could have said it was a rad yom, and that would mean a very long period of time. But he chose not to say that. God called the light day, the darkness he called night, and the evening and the morning were the first day. Genesis chapter 1 and verse 5. I have to believe that that day was 24 hours long, just like the following days. Why would it have to be millions or billions of years? Not to satisfy God, not because God is not powerful enough to do it all in one day. Surely, if he spoke the universe into existence, he was powerful enough to do it in 1 minute, 1 second, just with the time it would take for him to engage the thought. So it's actually amazing that he took a whole day just to create light and separate the light from the darkness and make that one day. But that's what he did. So when he uses the word that means a period of time, and then he defines it, that throws out the possibility of taking that period of time and making it mean eons of time. It was, as defined, a morning and an evening. And then, of course, sadly, there was no creator. But this just happened. There was a big bang. And somewhere, nothing came from nothing, and then that nothing exploded and became everything. And we're somehow supposed to believe that. The amazing thing about it is that that is a scientific position. If I read these verses in Genesis and I say that there was an almighty, all-powerful being that always has been, always will be, and he spoke this thing into existence, that's a faith position. But believing that somehow something came out of nothing, the nothing exploded and everything came out of that, that's science. And to believe anything other than that shows your ignorance. And that's what the world would have us to believe. And if you've never watched the movie Expelled, you can see in there when people that are in high positions in the education system stand up against these theories of the Big Bang, they are many times ostracized for their beliefs, kicked out of those positions of authority, and ridiculed by their associates. In Romans chapter 1 and verse 20, it says, "For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." Anybody that can look upon this world and see the greatness of it. How can you look at that and think that it happened as a manner of random sequences? How can you think that there was not something all-powerful behind it? It takes way more faith to believe that it just happened than it does to believe that an all-powerful God made it happen. I've just been reading where they're looking for the God molecule. I don't know if any of you have seen that, but this is somehow the Peter Hoggs is the guy that developed this theory, and it's called the Hoggs boson, or the Higgs boson, or the Higgs particle. It's Peter Higgs, I'm sorry. And they're looking for this God molecule because it can exist in a dimension, multiple dimensions at the same time. So it both is and is not at the same time. And so he's created this theory that if molecules are sped up to a certain speed, then you can determine this point at which the Higgs molecule or the God molecule will become into being in this dimension. And of course, then it could explode, and that could be what caused the universe. That's not the sad part. The sad part is we've spent billions of dollars to create a machine that'll move molecules so fast that maybe we can find that. And it's just amazing that our science looks at things that way. Well, I'm going to admit to you right now, I'm biased. When I'm introduced with a fact of science, the first thing I'm going to do is compare it to those things in the Bible. And if it doesn't fit the things in the Bible, then I'm going to know that somebody came up with the wrong conclusion. So my bias is that whatever is introduced as facts has to be compatible with the things in the Bible. And I'll admit that's a bias. The scientist doesn't want to admit that he's biased. He wants to admit my bias, but not his. But what is he doing? He's taking a new piece of evidence, and he is refusing to accept anything except the fact that it'll fit into his model of billions and billions of years. So he's biased too. So it's not a question of whether you're biased or not, but a question of which bias is the best bias to be biased with. And I'm going to be biased with the bias that says God is all powerful. He spoke this world and all that's in it into being. Some of the reasons that scientists give as evidence for an old earth, and I already see I'm going to have to speed up, but one of the big things that they talk about is they can measure the time that rocks have been exposed to cosmic rays, and the amount of time that they've been exposed to cosmic rays will determine the age of the universe. And they can measure up to 830,000 years by studying this effect of cosmic rays upon the surface of rocks. Closely related to that is the decay rates of nuclides. And that, you'll know one of the first of those is carbon dating, carbon-14 dating. However, that's for very limited amounts of time. So there are others that are rubidium, strontium, uranium, lead, and potassium, argon. And these look at the decay rates of isochrons and determine the age of things because of the age of these elements. And when they look at these elements and see that it will take a uranium molecule 3.5 billion years to decay fully, then they say, since they're there, and since there's uranium there, then it must be that the earth, and there's lead, that some of that uranium is fully exposed into lead, so therefore the earth must be 3.4 billion years old. So using logic like that is how they determine these real old ages. And of course, the amount of time that it takes for light to get from a far star to Earth. If that star's out there, and it would take that light 3.4 billion years to get to Earth, then that's how old the Earth is, at least. So all of these thoughts give evidence for an old earth. Minerals in the sea. They calculate how much minerals are in the sea and talk about how long it would take for those minerals to build up in the earth. So they go back and say, how long would it have been since the ocean water had no minerals in it at the current rate? And so they come up with a time of hundreds of millions or a billion years. And one that you're probably very familiar with is the rock layers laid down. For instance, when you look at the Grand Canyon and you have the cliffs exposed, and you can see how the sediments have been laid down in layers over time. And so they assume that every layer was laid down the same way over the same amount of time. So you can simply count those layers, multiply it by how long it takes one to get there, and that tells you how old the earth is. So you count those layers, you multiply that out, and that tells you how long that land mass has been there. So they come up with some very old calculations that way. And of course, a big one is fossils, because it takes millions of years for something to fossilize. So of course, this is the mineralization of the organic material in a bone, for instance, that the organic material in there is slowly replaced with mineralization from that's in water deposits as it passes through the bone, and the bone is saturated with it. So it takes millions of years for that to happen. So these are evidences that they use to say that the earth is very old. I want to look at rebuttals to these in the sense that there is a lot of evidence in the world that if scientists are willing to look at it, they would understand that show that the earth is very young. And this really probably the most important thing in understanding this is to thinking about the changes that the earth underwent at the time of Noah's flood. And if you think about cosmic rays, you think about the isochrons and the isotopes and their decay rates, all of these things would undoubtedly have been affected by a calamity of the magnitude that we read about at the time of Noah's flood. And this explains so many different aspects of things that they use to say that the earth is very old. In Genesis chapter 1, in verses 5 through 8, we're only beginning with verse 6, says, God said, let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters, and let it divide the waters from the waters. And God made the firmament and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament, and it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day. It's said by others smarter than me, if you want to see a dictionary stutter, look up firmament, because it's a very difficult concept to understand. And I'm not saying I understand exactly what the firmament was, but we see a lot of very interesting things in there, that the waters under the earth and the waters over the earth were separated from each other. Now, understanding that we're not yet into the whole land and bringing forth life and all of that. So what was this? And probably the most likely scenario is that there was a water vapor canopy around the earth instead of an atmosphere as we know it today, so that the atmosphere carried very much more water in it than it does today. And then many have suggested that there was subterranean chambers of waters under the earth, and that when the fountains of the great deep broke up, that this was water that was contained under the earth. And as that water that was under the earth was forced out of the earth and up into the atmosphere, it reacted with the water vapor around the earth and caused that to dissipate and fall back to earth. So a catastrophic event. And many have asked, well, where could all that water come from? How could it rain for that long using the regular water cycle? Where did all the water go if it rained for that long? How did it get rid of it? And this explains all of that, with the fountains of the great deep breaking up and creating valleys and mountains, as it tells us in Psalms, and draining the water off, that it changed the whole dynamics of the earth. And if you've ever been to a flood area and you see just a little flood, you see what happens with a flood. And there's just a lot of damage, a lot of debris, the sediments that are washed up, very difficult to clean up. And you can just imagine a flood of this magnitude. And we see in Genesis chapter 2, it talks about some of those differences in verses 4 through 6, looking particularly at verse 5. It says, every plant of the field before it was in the earth, and every herb of the field before it grew, and the Lord God had not caused it to rain upon the earth. And there was not a man to till the ground. But there went up a mist from the earth and watered the whole face of the ground. So we didn't have rain as we know it. The rain, the first time it rained, is the great flood. And of course, if you think about that and the fountains of the great deep breaking up and all of this rain coming down at one time, you can imagine the force and the severity. Of course, that assumes that there wouldn't have been large mountains and valleys and things like we know them, which appears to be the case when you look at the verses in Psalms that talk about the mountains and the valleys. In Genesis chapter 1, verses 29 through 30, it shows us that the plants were given for food, that even to the creatures upon the earth. So everything, everybody, and everything was vegetarians. So we didn't have carnivores, we had only herbivores. So all of that creation was vegetarians. So again, a major change in the earth. It was not until after the flood that people were told that they could eat meat. So we see just a major difference in the world. And I imagine there's nothing that we could do to explain how different that earth was. It would be very interesting to go back and look at that earth before time, but before the time of Noah's flood. But of course, we can't do that. But certainly it made great changes to the earth. So when they use the exposure to cosmic rays as a measure of time, and I can only imagine that cosmic rays shining through an atmosphere that was made up of mostly water vapor rather than the atmosphere we have today, that it would change those readings. It would change the ways that cosmic rays reflected upon the earth. Probably pretty dramatically. And if you think about it, we have people that were living almost 1,000 years. We have a totally different world at that time. And we have less sickness and decay and all of that in the world. But evidently there was something else about that world that allowed vegetation to prosper and allowed people to live these long, extended lives. And of course, in God's plan, that would be helpful in populating the earth and all of that as well. But I believe that earth that he created us in was designed to do just that, to allow them to live that long life and allow them to populate the earth at that time. So when we talk about cosmic rays reflecting off rocks, If the rock existed before the flood and existed after the flood, I'm sure the difference would be dramatic in the way that the cosmic rays would react to rocks. And of course, the assumption is that it's always been the same. So when you measure a rock and you find out how the cosmic rays have changed that rock, you use a straight line linear progression and you say it's been exposed to cosmic rays for this many years. And so that's how they come up with these old dates. So many people are willing to admit that a day in Genesis could be millions of years, but not willing to admit that a day of cosmic rays shining on a rock before the flood could have been a million days. We don't know. Or a million years. So the fact is, measuring something that we have no starting data. We don't know what it was when it started. We don't know the conditions for the time period that we're measuring becomes a meaningless measurement. So that's an argument against using cosmic rays to age something. In the decay rates of nuclides, probably we're most familiar with uranium and lead, and that actually has a half-life of 4.47 billion years. So theoretically, it could be used to accurately determine an age of 4.5 billion years. And it'd be interesting and worth your time to look up these kinds of dating methods and try to learn what you can. It's very technical, and to say it from here would probably not benefit any of us. But the important thing to understand about all of the dating methods is there are two very important assumptions to all the dating methods. Number one is that in the beginning, there was no decay that had already taken place. So you had pure uranium, whatever, rubidium, potassium, whatever the element is that you're measuring, there had been no pre-existing decay rate. And the second thing is that from the very beginning of time to today, that rate has stayed exactly the same, that no events upon Earth, no, you know, they tell us we've been hit by asteroids and we've nearly destroyed the Earth several times. That killed all the dinosaurs, changed the Earth. We're told about all these catastrophic events that have happened. And to use their dating method, we have to assume that none of those has ever affected the decay rate of an element. And I doubt very seriously that even that assumption's right, even for the short period of time that the Earth has been here. I would think that, again, all the cataclysmic events at the time of Noah's Ark probably changed a lot of those things as well. But trying to put it simple, the thing they do is they introduce a new mineral that will leach out the amount of lead that's in the uranium. And they can determine when they leach out that lead and take a ratio of that, it tells how long that's been there. So they'll take an element out of whatever it is they're aging. Zircon is the one they always look for because they say it's the most reliable. I said, well, if you're using one less reliable, how do you know you're getting a good date? But they'll use that if it's not available. So it's just very interesting when you look at the scientific process that they use, you can punch it full of holes. But they just throw it out there and throw it at you. The average person knows nothing about how they date this stuff, and we don't even know how to argue about it. But straight up, we can say, well, how do you know that when uranium came into being that it didn't already have an 80% decay rate, that it had already looked like it was 3 billion years old? How old do you think Adam was when he was created? He was one day old. How old did he look? I'm sure he looked like a grown man. I'm sure if you did DNA testing on him, he wouldn't have tested one day old. Same way with all of these things. And we just have to use our logic to say when these things came into being, they would not have been brand new. They would not have looked brand new. They would not have tested brand new. So the assumptions that are behind these dating methods are vitally important for us to understand. And so when we talk to people, you know, I've talked to some people who have a lot of scientific knowledge of these things. I say, well, what did you use as a baseline for the sample? How much decay did you assume in the very beginning? Well, none. Well, how do you know that's true? Well, we don't. But we have to assume that. Well, I don't have to assume that. That's the big difference between you and me. I would assume that there was probably already an 80% decay rate there to start. Well, you think about that. Well, I don't think you're right. I said, well, how can you prove I'm wrong? Well, I can't. okay? You can't prove you're right either. And so that's what it all becomes, is a battle of things that you can't prove. We can't prove creation. We can't make it happen again. We can't see it happen. Using the very scientific model, what we have to do is observe processes that we call experiments, repeatable tests, that we can watch the same thing happen time and again in order to understand that it's a fact. So we can't prove scientifically creation. Nobody's ever seen anything evolve into something else. You can't test that. You can't repeat a test. You can't observe it. Therefore, you can't prove that either. And there's no difference to accepting evolution as a fact that you can't prove and accepting creation as a fact that you can't prove. But our science would sure teach you different, wouldn't they? They would teach you that it's a faith position if you believe in creation. It's science if you believe in evolution and if you believe in millions and millions of years. So, likely, another big part of this is continental drift. So the assumption is that there was one continent, Pangaea. Some go back even further than that and say there was another supercontinent. It broke up and then came back together, and that's where Pangaea started. But the idea is that there was one supercontinent that broke up and gave us the continents that we have today. And if you look at them, they look like a puzzle that would fit right together. What does the Bible say about it? I believe the Bible actually does tell us that there was one continent in the beginning. In Genesis chapter 1 and verse 9, God said, "Let the waters under the heaven be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear," and it was so. Well, if the water was all gathered together into one place, then that only left one place for the land. So we couldn't have had all the separate bodies of water that we have. We would have had one supercontinent. So I believe that, in fact, the Bible does tell us that in the beginning there was one supercontinent. I believe that it was broken up, most likely that it was broken up at the time of the flood, when the fountains of the great deep broke up. We can find that in Genesis chapter 7 and verse 11. It says, "In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month and 17th day of the month, is the same day where all the fountains of the great deep broken up and the windows of heaven were opened." So very likely that could have caused the breaking up of the continents. But Genesis chapter 10 and verse 25 is very interesting too. It says, "Unto Eber were born two sons. The name of one was Peleg, for in his days the earth divided, and his brother's name was Joktan." Many people have said that this is probably the events that happened at the Tower of Babel, that the people was divided. But it says the earth was divided, so I'm not sure that it wasn't at this time that the earth was divided into separate continents. And again, I don't know that we can prove that, but when we look at the context of it and everything else, there's not enough to give us a definitive answer. But it could be that the earth was divided in these days and at this event. And all we really know for sure is what we have now. And we have continents that sit where they sit, they're moving slightly, and they look like they would fit together if you just folded them up and moved them around a little bit. And again, I meant to get a PowerPoint together. I just didn't have time. But there's a neat graphic that you can see of the continents as they fold up and they fit back together. And it looks very likely that that happened. And again, based on the scriptures, that would actually confirm the scriptures, not refute the scriptures, as science tries to use that as something that had to take millions of years to happen. It could have happened very rapidly at the time of the flood, or it could be in Genesis chapter 10 and 25 that it was done miraculously in a very short period of time. After all, we're talking about a God who made it. If he wanted to divide it, he could do that just as quickly and easily as he made it. Psalms 104 talks about the mountains and the valleys. And, of course, one of the big questions is, where did the water go from the flood? That's a thing that you hear often when you're talking about, you know, how could you flood the earth way over top of the highest mountains, and where would the water go? In Psalms 104, it says, they go up by the mountains, and they go down by the valleys unto the place that thou hast founded for them. And thou hast set a bound that they may not pass over, that they turn not again to cover the earth. And so it's talking about the great waters. In verse 6, thou coveredest with the deep as with a garment, and the water stood above the mountains. So it gives us an example there of the mountains going up, the valleys going down, and the water dissipating, going into new places that God had formed for them to go in. Again, definitely could explain things like the Grand Canyon, could explain the continents coming apart, definitely the big trenches, the Mid-Atlantic Rift, and all of those kind of things are easily explained by these verses. The fountains of the great deep break it up, Psalms chapter 104. All of these things are scientific evidence that shows what scientists say took millions and millions of years to happen could have happened very quickly at the time of Noah's flood, and most likely did happen at that time. Science will tell us the continents allegedly broke up 200 million years ago. They do that by looking at the sediment along the Mid-Atlantic Rift, and they say it's built up to a level that will show it to be 200 million years old. I would submit that most of those deposits happened right at the time of Noah's flood, and that a very little bit of that has happened since. But they also tell us that Australia is moving at 7.62 centimeters a year. And I did some math on that, and within 200 million years, Australia would have already circled the Earth at its latitude. So they've got a few different calculations that are messed up, because they're the ones that want to assume that it's always, if it moves 7.62 centimeters a year today, then it's always moved 7.62 centimeters. Well, of course, my thought would be that it was moving very much faster than that if it was created by the flood, and that it's still slowing down, and that each year it'll move slower and slower before it goes over and bumps into South America. But if you look at the constants, though, there's no way that looking at earthquakes and all the tsunamis and all the crazy weather experiences that we have, that you can say nothing ever happened that would change the drift rates of those continents, regardless of what caused them. If you don't believe it was God that caused them, how can you still say that they've always moved at the same rate? You can't. And yet that is part of their argument when they say that the Atlantic Ocean is 200 million years old, because that sediment in the bottom of it's piled up at the same rate for 200 million years. And we know definitively that that's how it got there, and that's how long it took to put it there. And then we talked about the rock layers. And there's a whole lot we could say about those. We're about out of time. But again, these things probably laid down rapidly at the time of Noah's flood. And we can imagine that there was a lot of volcanic activity and things that were triggered by the fountains of the great deep breaking up, lava flows, and those kind of things. And Steve Austin from ICR, the Institute of Creation Research, went to Mount St. Helens, and he did a potassium-argon test on Mount St. Helens 11 years after it happened, and it dated to be 300,000 years in just 11 years. Now, there's several different tests you could do with that to confirm that age. You could bisect that and look at the layers that build up, and you would see a lot of layers. So you would take the math and you would say, okay, we know that it takes this many years for that layer to build up, and we do the math and we come up with a lot of years. and we can see something that happened right within our lifetimes that we can remember, that science would date to be 300,000 years old, but really is 11 years old. And so when he took that and presented it to the science, said, well, you can't use potassium argon unless something's at least 100,000 years old. Well, since there's nothing 100,000 years old, you basically can't use potassium argon. But you see, the answer is never, oh, wow, well, we really messed that one up. The answer is always, well, this scenario has to exist before you can use that. So it's never throw something out. It's always change the assumptions. Change how that fits into our model. And so they continue to fit whatever evidence comes their way into the model that the Earth has to be 4.5 billion years old. And they won't have anything else. Minerals in the sea, they use that as a clock, saying that the minerals have been deposited at a steady rate over the period of time. And it shows, again, confirming the fact that the ocean is a couple hundred million years old. And a lot of research was done on that, looking at both the amount of salinity that goes into the ocean and the amount that comes out. And skipping through a lot of this, they did the 457 million tons of salt and minerals go into the ocean each year. 122 million are ejected out by spray and evaporation and different processes. And if you use those numbers, it would date the ocean to be 62 million years old. So using the current salinity of the Earth and taking into account not only what went in, but what goes out. The scientist, he just looks at what goes in, and it gives a distorted view of that, and how much is actually there. But looking at the fact that, and they assume that the salinity was nothing to start with. Well, if God created the animals that live in the sea, there had to be enough salinity, or the ocean, there had to be enough salinity in there to support that life. So there is a perfect example of what's wrong with their assumptions. You can't assume zero salinity and so much adding each year. You have to assume at least enough to support that marine life that supposedly evolved out of the oceans to start with. So they defeat their big argument that life began in the oceans, the hydrothermal vents, and slowly evolved into the life forms that we have now. Well, they couldn't have even existed if their assumption about salinity and minerals in the ocean was true, because it would have never supported life. So it had to have those things in it to begin. And so when you add all of those assumptions, we see that the ocean is really very young, and that if there had been hundreds of millions of years, the Earth would have a higher salinity than the Dead Sea, and it would be impossible for anything to live in it. So it has to be in that range that it's gone from having enough and still doesn't have too much. Many other things that we could look at. We're just out of time. I wanted to talk just a minute about the fossil record, because this is something that has always been used to teach the ages, that it takes so long for something to become fossilized. It takes so long for something to become fossil fuels. Well, I remember when I was in high school and we were first getting to the edge of that first crisis with oil and stuff. And then I was actually in college when that hit in the 80s. And all the talk was, we're going to be completely out of fossil fuels by the year 2020. Now, when we measure our fossil fuels today, we have more than we had in 1982 when they said we were going to run out in 2020. How can that be if it takes millions and millions of years to create fossil fuel? Well, we just found more. Well, of course, I believe that the Earth is continuously producing those things and that it's not millions and millions of years. It doesn't take that much time. ICR created coal out of wood in 7 days by putting the right amount of pressure and heat on it. They demonstrated that we can produce a fossil fuel in 7 days. Of course, science still doesn't want to accept that. No, it takes millions of years. And it takes millions of years to create a fossil. Well, maybe you've heard about all the different fossilized items that have been found, but it's very interesting. But one of my favorites is looking in a gold mine in Australia. They found a miner's hat that had been completely fossilized. I guess it evolved from a soft hat into a hard hat. But they had a hat, and it's on display in a museum in Australia that is completely fossilized. How could it take millions of years? It doesn't. It just takes the right conditions for something to fossilize. The right temperatures, the right pressure can turn those things into fossil fuels, can turn them into fossils, and it doesn't take millions of years. Well, now, I remember the definition of fossils vaguely from when I was in school, and a vital part of that definition was the mineralizations of the organic material in a fossil. I wanted to get that exactly right, so I looked up what a fossil is today. And what it says now is that it is a remnant or a trace of an organism of a past geological age, such as a skeleton or a leaf imprint embedded and preserved in the Earth's crust. That's from the American Heritage Dictionary. I looked it up in several dictionaries, and they were very similar to that. So the idea of the mineralization is not even included in the definition of a fossil anymore. I don't know if it's because it's been demonstrated that it doesn't take millions of years, but it used to be the gradual replacing of organic materials with minerals by the saturation of water. I tried to find an old dictionary, but I couldn't find one that I could look that up in. But check me on that, because I'm sure that if you look back 30 or 40 years ago, that was the very important part of the definition of a fossil. Now they've abandoned that, and it's just a remnant or a trace of something that used to be. And there's so much more with the rock layers, and there's trees. There's trees that go through multiple rock layers. Some that go through rock layers that would date 60 million years different from the top of the tree to the bottom of the tree, and the wood is not even petrified. You know, how do we answer that? You know, how can there be a tree deposited in 60 million years worth of sedimentary layers and still not be fossilized? Obviously, it's not 60 million years old, but it was deposited there catastrophically by the flood or some major catastrophe like that. And so these evidences, you can find them just one after another. I have several other things in here I wanted to get to, but all of these things show us that the Earth is really young. And this is, it's scientific evidence that if you use the calculations and if you understand the processes that they use, there's many things that prove that the Earth is young. There are still some things we may not have the answer to yet. But as people study them and they'll come to a knowledge of it, we'll be able to understand how all of these things fit into the picture that's painted in the Bible of an Earth that was created in 6 days. Why is this important to us? It's important to us because we need to know that God is all-powerful. That if he tells us he created it in 6 days, that's what he did. And he did it exactly like he said. And when he tells us what we must do in order to be saved, he tells us exactly what we must do. He doesn't add things. He doesn't leave things out. He doesn't leave a lot of it up to our interpretation of those things. He gives us what we need to be perfectly and thoroughly furnished, as the Bible tells us, to know what we must do in order to be saved. He's powerful enough to create this universe. He's powerful enough to save us. And he's given us that plan that we must follow in order to be saved, to hear his word, to believe it, to repent of our past sins, to change our will to do his will, to confess our belief publicly in him as the Son of God, to be buried with him in baptism, to rise and walk in newness of life. If you've not done those things, you need to do that. You need to understand that this same powerful God that created this world has promised us one thing. One day he's going to destroy this world and all that's in it. And everyone that's in it that is not prepared to meet him will be destroyed. You have an opportunity before you today to render yourself in obedience to his will, to make sure that you will not be in that number that's destroyed when the heavens and the earth pass away. If you're subject to the gospel call, won't you come when we stand and sing the songs?